Welcome to Rust Belt Science. I'm your host, Maggie Fink.
And I'm Shahir Risk.
And today we have with us Professor Bill Sullivan. Shahir, do you want to give us an introduction?
Yes, of course. Professor Bill Sullivan is a Showalter professor at Indiana University School of Medicine. He received his PhD in cell and molecular biology from the University of Pennsylvania. He's published hundreds of articles on infectious diseases. He also published an amazing book called Pleased to Meet Me, Genes, Germs, and the Curious Forces That Make Us Who We Are. Bill, welcome to Rust Belt Science.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for the kind words about the book.
Of course.
All right, so the first thing we do when we have any guest on is we ask one question that's not related to anything, your research or any of your work or anything like that. But we want to know, is there anything that you are reading, listening to, or watching right now that you'd like to share with the audience that you're super excited about? Doesn't have to be about science. It could be, we get a lot of science fiction books on here from other researchers, but is there anything you're consuming right now that's interesting?
Yes, I am happy to divulge some of my entertainment diet.
Perfect.
In terms of what I'm watching, I just finished the Netflix series with Ted Danson called A Man on the Inside, which is wonderful. Highly recommend it. Ted Danson probably does some of his strongest work ever in this charming little mystery that he becomes wrapped up in. He's a retired university professor and rather bored with his life and gets recruited to solve this theft mystery that's taking place in a retirement home. Mm-hmm. So he infiltrates this retirement community and tries to solve the mystery, which is just one element of the show. The real beauty of the show comes out as he befriends some of the characters in this retirement home and gets to know their stories and how he helps them along, even though one of them may be a suspect all along. So really cool show.
Yeah.
In terms of what I'm reading, I don't want to get the title wrong. So I'm looking over at my bookshelf. It is the latest book from Amanda Montell, whose mother actually is a very famous cell biologist.
Mm-hmm.
And her new book is called The Art of Magical Overthinking.
Oh,
and it's just
okay.
This extraordinary compilation of essays that take a look at some of the cognitive biases that we all suffer from as evolved primates, mm-hmm. and hilariously puts them into stories that really just make you think twice about the way you perceive and interpret events in your lives and how other people do the same. So really cool book.
That sounds really cool. I wrote the name down, The Art of Magical Overthinking.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, little play on the title for,
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds like it's for me because I overthink everything. So.
Really?
I think so.
You think?
Yeah. That's a good recommendation.
No.
Okay. All right. Awesome. Thank you for those recommendations.
Excellent.
I've been needing a new show to watch in particular, and I love Ted Danson. So.
Yeah. This sounds like a cool show. Do you think this is like aspiration for retirement? Like, you know, solving crimes?
In a retirement home? That sounds excellent.
I hope not to be there for a while yet longer. But it's not too far from what we do as scientists, right?
I mean,
you really do try to formulate a hypothesis, mm-hmm. gather clues, and test it. So in a lot of ways, detective work is essentially what we do in a laboratory setting.
That is true. And in fact, you know, we tend to refer to professors who are lab leaders as PIs, which basically stands for principal investigators. You say, this is my PI. You know, this is the principal and this is the boss because ultimately we're investigators, right? Yeah.
I think and we all know that. Everyone in science knows that.
Yeah.
So when we say PI, all of us speak that language.
Mm-hmm,
we know
mm-hmm.
it stands for principal investigator in the context of doing science.
Yeah.
But I think when I first met my wife, Lori, so many years ago, I used the word PI offhandedly without even explaining it. And she turns to me and just calls me who are you, Magnum?
Magnum PI. I love it. This is great. So that actually brings me to a very important point that you're really hitting on here, which is kind of the jargon in science. We use all of these words and abbreviations, this language that we only know. And in fact, it can be so esoteric that even people within the same field, only the people within that one field know, and not all scientists know. And so that really, as you know very well, it can alienate a lot of people, non-scientists, as you might want to call them, or the general public, from what we do. And it seems like we're just speaking a different language. Are we speaking a different language? And I know that's the first part of the question. Second part is, I know you're doing a lot of efforts, you know, a lot of your efforts are going to science communication. So is this what's happening, and what are you doing about it?
Yeah, that's an excellent question and really innovative segue. We certainly do have our own language within science. And I would go even one step further and say sub-disciplines have their own dialects and accents. Uh-huh. Like, I'm still trying to speak immunology. I haven't picked that up yet.
That's my least favorite one.
Yeah, I don't think you're alone there, Maggie. It's a really tough language. It's like the Latin of languages. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, I don't think that's specific to the scientific discipline. My son is a business major, and my wife it has an MBA as well. And when they get to talking about numbers and stuff, I'm at a loss. I don't know what all this what all these things mean. I think it's not unusual for people who get advanced in their career and really get enmeshed in it. You know, you do learn these specific languages, but I certainly don't counter the claim that science really goes off the deep end in terms of jargon.
Right.
And the unfortunate expectation many scientists and doctors have, which is that the general public understands this crazy language that we speak.
Yeah.
So our job as science communicators is try to interpret this esoteric language and this jargon-rich technical dialogue into more palatable forms that people can understand, so that they can, one, appreciate what science and medicine and health has to offer, and two, extract practical information from this realm of science that they can use in their daily lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. So that it's about curiosity, but also something that they can use at the end of the day, something that they feel like it's impacting their lives. And you do a lot of things. I mean, you're an editor and a writer for PLOS, SciComm, Public Library Science Communication, and the chair of the editorial advisory board at ASBMB. That's the American Society for Biochemistry and Molecular Biology, right? Today.
More acronyms. Jargon.
More jargon, right? More jargon.
We really do love our acronyms.
Yeah. It's, you know, I actually tell my students, you know, whenever we're studying chemistry and we have to abbreviate a lot of our structures into, you know, kind of shorthand so that we don't have to draw these very, very large molecules, I just say, chemists are lazy, scientists are lazy. So we just go with shorthand.
That's
but,
true.
You know, we tend to do these things. And somehow, like you said, it just kind of might separate us from even people within our within our disciplines. So you do a lot of writing, and you write a lot about science communication, but you also write a lot of things to explain what's happening. So tell us a little bit more about what you do and maybe some of the examples that you've done recently, and why it's important to be effective at science communication for all of us as scientists.
Right. So I'll speak to its importance first. We hit on that a little bit already. I think it's critically important, especially in these days and times where you can find just about any piece of information on the internet to justify a belief or an idea. It's really important for the experts to step up to that podium and do the timeout, you know, and say, hey, here's the real deal. You know, here's the real scoop. And, you know, say it in a way that doesn't alienate people. or talk down to them, right, or make them feel like you're an elitist and you're being condescending. We want to avoid all of those pitfalls and communicate with the public as you would a friend at a coffee house or a bar, you know, and just try to communicate this on a more human level. Tell stories. Circling back to your really good point about curiosity, explain what got you interested in this sort of thing, or what is it about it that fascinates you so much, and why you might expect someone else to be fascinated once they understand it. Mm-hmm. That I think is really important. And this feeds into propagating our ability to continue to do science and deliver valuable medical advice and form evidence-based policy. If people get an appreciation for that and regain trust and respect for scientists and doctors, it makes our lives a lot easier, mm-hmm, and it makes our communities a lot healthier.
Yeah, I was going to ask, and you kind of already answered it, and maybe we can find some more ways to discuss it. But, you know, talking about jargon across all careers, my husband makes cardboard boxes. Technically, that is incorrect, but the laymen would call them cardboard boxes. But the jargon is corrugated, right? And there's a lot of technical terms there. But for the...
I understood cardboard boxes.
Yeah.
Yes.
If you would have said corrugated, I'd be like, huh?
Yeah. So hopefully if my husband ever listens to this, he won't get mad at me for calling them a cardboard box, because now in our house, we have to say corrugated, even the kids, corrugated. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the ramifications of you calling it a cardboard box and not calling it by its technical name are very, very low, right? But the ramifications of people not using scientific information correctly or getting things wrong in a lot of cases can be really serious. And especially when we start to get into things like public health and the policies that are put into place because of that. So, you know, almost all scientific disciplines, I feel like, have a lot more weight to them as far as their impact on human societies. So do you think, over your career, you've seen this become a bigger problem with the rise of things like social media? Or do you think this is kind of an inherent part of society where scientists and this pursuit of knowledge are kind of othered in society in some way?
No, that's a great question. I think it's definitely been around forever. There's always been disinformation and opposing viewpoints or resistance to embracing new evidence that changes paradigms that people have clung on to for a very long time. You two may be familiar with really ancient 19th century political cartoons bashing vaccination.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
I mean, this has been around since vaccination became a thing.
Yes.
The vaccination's been around since 900 AD, The person who really catapulted it into the stratosphere was Edward Jenner,
right,
with the cowpox smallpox vaccine. And that health movement to get everybody vaccinated so that we could defeat smallpox was met with a surprising amount of resistance, which most people today would take for granted as, I can't believe anyone would be opposed to the smallpox vaccination as devastating disease. Mm-hmm. But here we are 200 some years later, still arguing about the same fundamental issues of a technology that's been around literally since 900 AD.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, you bring up those cartoons. If anybody's listening, you should look up those cartoons. They show people getting the vaccine from cowpox and turning into cows and
right,
bulls as they're being vaccinated. And it's just saying, this is not natural. This is against nature. Now, we know that there are a lot of natural things that will also kill us. Like, you know, TB is natural. Snake venom is natural. You know, all of those things are natural. And I think that there's this misconception somehow. So, yeah, check out those cartoons because they are super cool.
Good.
Yeah.
There's a formal name for that. It's called the natural fallacy. Uh-huh. And but to your point, Shahir, cowpox is natural. Yes. It's not like you're putting something abnormal into the body. And of course, you know, as time evolved, we got even better at making antigens, so we wouldn't have to jeopardize someone's health. We didn't actually want someone to get cowpox, so we just put in the one viral protein that we know will work. Yeah. And so it's an even better form of vaccination. And that's where we got to get really careful. And, to in order to explain it to the public in a way that they will understand, that, you know, take mRNA as the newest level of vaccination, has a lot of wonderful advantages over the old protein-based vaccines. But at the end of the day, they're essentially the same. They work in the same capacity. And I think by and large, the scientific and medical community stumbled with regard to how to explain that technology to the general public and why, despite the fact that it's got a new name and yeah, it's a novel approach, at the end of the day, it essentially does the same thing. Mm-hmm. And you know, we failed to educate people on the many clinical trials that were done that showed that this is absolutely safe. You know, it's not going to turn you into a cow. It's not going to turn you into a COVID virus. Yeah. You know, this is perfectly safe. And like you said, mRNA is natural.
Yes.
We've seen protests of, I don't want any mRNA in my body. Oh, hey, I got news for you, pal.
Yeah.
You're full of mRNA, whether you like it or not.
That's right.
This just speaks to a gross scientific illiteracy in our general public. And I'm not blaming anyone.
Yeah.
But what's at fault here? Maybe, you know, you might be able to blame our education system to some degree. The sciences are not emphasized robustly enough. But we also have this mentality, especially in America, that once you're done high school or college, you're done educating yourself. And we got to walk away from that. That is utterly wrong. And get people, to stay up to speed with some of the latest in science and technology for their own benefit. And this is going to manifest itself in a variety of ways. I know, like IU, for example, does lifelong learning courses where people are free for a very low, you know, fee to go sign up and take classes that keep them up to date on the latest and greatest of everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can try to put the onus on yourself, but we don't teach people on how to find the correct information. So they can go down rabbit holes of conspiracy theory thinking they're doing quote research when in fact they really don't know what that means. They don't know how to critically think and evaluate. They don't know the importance of sources. They don't understand scientific or medical consensus and what the principles of that is. I think we can do a much better job educating our communities as to what science is really all about and what makes it tick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how do we do that as scientists without making people feel stupid and like, well, you just didn't take that class, or, you know, you don't care enough, or you know, if they're following some conspiracy theory, you know, talking to people about that can make them feel really intimidated and stupid. And so actually, you know, might turn them even further away as we try to interact. And I think you mentioned a little bit about the different avenues like storytelling and connecting to people, but this is all great. But then when you try it, people feel kind of attacked. What do we do about that as scientists?
Yeah, no, that's a fantastic question. And I'm not sure there's a one size fits all answer because you always have to communicate based on who your audience is at the time. And that's going to vary. So the way I prefer to do these sorts of things is to get away from the mob mentality, get away from groups. Okay. People think differently when they're in groups. And there's a lot of studies that suggest how dumb we get as individuals when we are in groups because a completely different psychological dynamic takes place. Okay. So I like talking to people on a one-to-one basis, and I can't change the world that way, but I can certainly try to make a difference in seeding a few minds who can then go on and tell people, hey, man, I met this you know, scientist, and he wasn't a jerk, you know, he really did know or convince me of something or bring my attention to something I haven't considered. And, you know, I think we can trust him. You know, he doesn't seem to be, involved in any of these conspiracy theories that so many people embrace.
So
doing that, I think storytelling is important, sharing personal experiences, but also becoming, you know, there are moments, Maggie, when you got to listen more than you talk. And scientists, in my experience, are really bad at this. They love to pile on the evidence because that's what we have to do to defend our work, right? That's our modus operandi in scientific circles. But when you're trying to communicate science with someone, I think some of the more valuable things you can learn through this kind of motivational interviewing of the person you're talking to is first understand why they believe what they do. You know, if it's counter to consensus or what they should be believing in, you don't just want to ram a whole bunch of data and charts down their throat or pile evidence on if they don't trust you to begin with, or if they're suspicious of the so-called elites and whatnot. You have to understand where those sentiments are coming from, what has fomented this belief that they have. And you also want to understand more about them. You know, what life experiences have they had that led them to this belief, okay, or this opinion? And you can usually identify something as you're listening that you can latch on to and maybe use to your advantage, for lack of a better phrase, in trying to make a persuasive argument. All right. So I can try to give you a quick example. You know, when I was talking to someone about, you know, some sort of vaccine stuff, found out that they're actually a big fan of Star Trek. So am I. So my conversation pivoted immediately to, what did you think of that episode where they vaccinated? Blah, 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 blah.
Well done. Well played.
So those are the things you have to pry into. And once you find those common values, people can relate to you a lot more easily. So that would be my advice on the one-to-one front.
It's you might be aware of this already, but we've run into several people in the community who are flat earthers. And it's actually been kind of delightful, actually, to just connect with people that you disagree with so much on so many things, or aren't on that one thing, but you also share so much with them, at the very least, that we live in the same community. We're experiencing the same weather. We know the same people. We walk the same streets. You know, there's so much more that we have in common and, you know, to be able to ruin that kind of relationship over their belief that the earth is flat, I think will also ruin all of the other things that we share. And then you're losing your neighbors. You're losing your community that way. So, you know, that's why I really like what you said, is just finding that common thing, whether it's Star Trek or whether it's just the fact that we don't like the weather here or whatever it might be. So just the shared interest.
We have so much more in common than we do differences. And you're right. We have to tap into that if we are going to make a connection. And again, sometimes the goal is not immediate persuasion. I think you're fighting losing battles if that's if that's your ambition.
Agreed.
You're taking baby steps here to build a relationship, to build trust, and then build up from there, you know?
Perfect.
Yeah, I see a lot of scientists really want to make a difference, really want to engage with the communities, but it can be really difficult because you don't get that immediate gratification of somebody being like, I'll go take the vaccine today. Thank you.
You flipped that switch, and now I want to do everything that you told me to do.
And I don't think that's very realistic. And as scientists, we should know that.
And I think, you know, you said scientists can talk and talk and don't listen, but I think, you know, a little bit of the defense of the scientists, we are, most of us, just giant nerds and really like what we do and like the information that we have to share. And we think it's super cool.
It's the coolest.
And so I think it can be misconstrued as kind of just, you know, overloading people with information and data. And to us, we already know the story behind the data. Like, we don't have to explain it, but people don't know how to think that way about information. They need that story to kind of be laid out for them a little bit more, like an actual story instead of a bunch of data.
Absolutely. Yeah. I couldn't agree more. But I think there is a difference in the tone that you have. You know, if you're just genuine, enthusiastic, or fascinated about a topic, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. But to say it condescendingly or in a preachy way, that's a completely different approach. And I would assume you do the former. and in that case, talk on. I think that that's just fine.
So then on that note, how do you balance transparency with, you know, not overloading someone with information? And you mentioned something like the most recent COVID vaccine and its variations, especially the mRNA vaccine. You know, we as scientists, we just wanted to give everybody everything, every piece of information, the second that it came out. And of course, you know, there's no such thing as 100% safe or 100% effective. There's always going to be a risk for anything. You know, you drive over a bridge, there's always a risk that it's going to collapse, but obviously you don't want to take a chance swimming across the bay, right? That's a very different chance. But, you know, I felt like maybe we were inundating people with information. Like you said, maybe not doing a good job communicating, but then how do you balance transparency with that, which is our duty as scientists to be transparent? How do we manage that? I don't know if you even know the answer to that.
It's something that we struggle with on a case-by-case basis because there's different caveats and, you know, shortcomings to just about every medical discussion you can have. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right. Nothing is without risk. I mean, waking up every morning has its own risks, you know, just simple existence. You're going to be taking risks. Yeah. So the way I like to try to frame this is in a cost-benefit ratio. Most people understand that. Yeah. And if not, it only takes a sentence or two to explain what that concept means. But I think we would be making a mistake if we deny any risk or side effect that could potentially be true. Even though it may be extraordinarily rare, we should at least acknowledge its existence. To not do that would be dishonest, and that is the piece of information they are going to remember.
Right.
Okay. Even if the vast majority of what you said was true, if there was like one little nugget of, you know, a little seed of distrust that they can latch onto, that might be enough for their cognitive bias, the confirmation bias, to just light up like gangbusters, and then you've lost everything.
Right.
So you can't be disingenuous about potential side effects of a treatment or the risks that might be associated. But you do need to stress the reality of how rare they may be or how unusual they may be. Paul Offit does a wonderful job of this. You can Google him on YouTube or read some of his books. Yeah, he works at CHOP, the Children's Hospital, Philadelphia, and just does a marvelous job teaching both professionals as well as the lay public how science and medicine works, and the fact that none of it is risk-free. Nothing that you do is risk-free. But there are risks of not doing what the experts say that should be at the front of your mind.
Right.
So Shahir and I just listened to a podcast recently that kind of touched on some of these things with communicating specifically like medical information, vaccines to the general public. But then there's like this gap communicating the actual science behind what, for example, mRNA is, and, you know, how do antibodies even work? So, and I do feel frustrated with that gap sometimes of like, okay, we can convince people that this vaccine is safe, right? But then how do vaccines actually work? What is the actual science behind that? And then getting, you know, down to some basic science, you know, my research is pretty basic science. I'm not really trying to work on the more translational side of things. Obviously there's applications, but that's where I feel like I struggle to figure out good ways to communicate that and to convince people they should care about things that don't have these kind of immediate public health issues. And do you have any comments about how we as scientists can be just get people excited about science for science's sake, so that when these things like COVID come up, people are more primed to accept and be receptive to how that actually applies to their life? Maybe that's a wordy question. I apologize. But that's just been on my mind lately about what about just basic science?
No, I think that's that is a real challenge. And it, again, it's not something that you can construct in a day. This is going to take the effort of many scientists and medical professionals time and time again to continue doing this. It takes patience, it takes resilience, and it takes some courage at times, especially if you go before a crowd that believes something that is not in line with your own thoughts. Okay. I have lectured at churches on some of the content of my book. And that can be a real challenge, you know, very, really fine lines to work when you're talking about evolutionary psychology. And there's some people in the audience who haven't even bought into evolution yet. So, but these are the things that I welcome, because otherwise I'm just preaching to the choir all day. And that's fun in its own way. I love the choir. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. I can sing with them anytime. But what I like to do is bring new people into our fold, you know, to get them to see the benefits of science and medicine so that we can strengthen our communities and, you know, continue to fund very worthy endeavors that are going to either save lives or improve the quality of life. So the approach that I have enjoyed taking and a formula that I've found to be really successful is fusing elements of cult, pop culture and news with science. So that if you think about it or look for it, you can find many instances of worthy topics relating to basic science or even more translational science embedded in all kinds of pop culture, TV shows, movies, song, art. There's no end to the list. And this is what got my blog started way back in 2014. I started it with a colleague of mine at IU School of Medicine. And we used to get together for lunch every now and then and just talk about some of the new shows we saw and what the science validity was behind it. You know, whether they were on the mark or they were way off. We had fun talking about that. And we got the idea one day to, you know, blogging was common in 2014. As you know, no offense, but as common as podcasting is.
That's true. But
back then, we didn't have podcasting. We did blogs. So we started The Scope. And he kind of specialized more in sci-fi stuff, you know, Star Trek and, you know, some of the technologies associated with that, and actually got a book deal out of it too. And my stuff gravitated more towards human behavior. I saw so-and-so on this show doing something and I can explain like the evolutionary psychology behind that, or I can start to explain the biology that underpins certain behavior. Everything from like overeating to drug addiction to depression and all the other things that I talk about in my book, actually. If you go, if you know, I'm not advocating people do this, but if you go back and study all the Scope postings I did, you can see a lot of the elements of my book actually got started there. So you know, that is a really successful formula, because people come for the pop culture and they stay for the science. You know what I mean? Someone put it to me in an analogy where you're taking the medicine for your dog, but you're wrapping it in cheese. and that's the way you get the dog to take the medicine. So this is kind of like my writing is perfect. It's medicinal, but yeah, it's really cheesy.
Well, but this is why I actually really enjoyed your book. And again, readers, I mean, listeners, get out there and get a copy of this book.
Yes,
please, to meet me. And what I really love about it is exactly what you said. It's wrapping that pop culture into the stories. And I think that especially the references to music from the 80s and 90s, I'm dating myself here, from the 80s and 90s, and TV shows and movies, it really makes it very easy to read. And I end up learning a lot. Now, again, as a scientist myself, I knew some of the things that you mentioned in the book, but I learned so much more. And so this is really where writing kind of transcends the various audiences, where you can have someone who really doesn't know very much about what genes are, what they do, or that they translate into proteins or enzymes and they do things, to someone who might know some of these things but doesn't know the details. And it's a really kind of a nice exploration of who we are. And there's the psychology part, which I know very little about, so that was really enjoyable to learn about. And then, of course, there's the biology part. So I really enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you so much. Yeah. I never tire of hearing that. So I'm delighted that you extracted that kind of joy out of it. But that's exactly what I was going for. And that's why it's so rewarding to hear, you know, mission accomplished. Yeah, I wanted to tell people about the latest and greatest in science and how it relates to their lives and how they understand other people and why they do the things they do. But I did want to do it in a way that made people want to turn to the next page. And I found that, you know, much like you've done in your book, through storytelling, you know, whether it be my own personal experiences or through a bit of humor or relating it to something that everybody knows about in pop culture,
right,
that's a real winning ticket for science communicators to keep in mind.
Are you doing a plug for our book?
I was trying to.
Well, Maggie, what is the name of our book?
The Color of North.
The Color of North. All right. Very good. See, this is the shameless plug for our book. This is a shameless plug time. Excellent.
Yeah. I'll say I read an advanced copy. I even wrote you a blurb.
Oh, yeah.
It's a wonderful book.
Well, thank you.
You know, there's other people can learn from the storytelling elements that the two of you have incorporated into your narrative as well. And it's really unique because, to the best of my knowledge, and I've read a lot of science books, okay, I don't remember reading any that are this vibrant and informative about what proteins actually do.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, yeah, okay. Well, we never tire of hearing that, too. So very nice to hear.
It fills a real void that's out there in the pop science literature.
Excellent. I think that was really the motivation, because there wasn't really anything that talked specifically and exclusively about or explicitly about proteins. And, you know, we know so much about genes and DNA, and this is really what we wanted to do. I want to focus more on your research.
Sure.
And talk a little bit about the little organism that you work with. Toxoplasma, this is a very interesting unicellular parasite, yes? With maybe some mind control powers. Can you tell us a little bit about toxoplasma? What interested you in it, and why is it important to study it?
Yeah, this is the parasite that I have dedicated my entire career to studying. And, you know, like I said, I had a lot of 80s lyrics in my book, so that dates me and how long I've been working on this parasite. So, I could talk about this all day. So if I'm going on too long, cut me off.
Okay, you're good. Keep going. Yeah.
So like you said, it is a single-celled organism. It's what we call protozoan parasite. And it's extraordinarily common. One-third of the world is believed to be infected with this parasite. Okay?
We're so pointing at each other here. Yeah.
It's like one out of every three people, which is just a staggering amount of people. And it's not like you get infected and it goes away. If you get infected with this parasite, you carry it around for the rest of your life. And where do you carry it? Mostly in your brain. So it's just like kind of blows my mind, no pun intended, that people en masse don't know about this, you know? And I didn't know about it until I got to grad school and did a rotation with Dr. David Roos at University of Penn. I never heard of toxoplasma before. I probably never would have if I didn't cross paths with him. But it's a fascinating parasite, not only because it's a pathogen in its own right, but it's also a good model for the study of more high-profile parasites like Plasmodium, which causes malaria, which I know you worked on, Shihir.
Yes.
And, you know, Toxoplasma has that win-win story behind it, and that, yeah, it's an important pathogen. A lot of people know about it. It's understudied. It's kind of a neglected disease, if you will. But it can also be a good model for the study of parasites that cause malaria and some truly devastating diseases that need urgent attention because there's not a lot of drugs to treat them. So why is this thing so common and why haven't people heard about it? Well, the reason it's so common is you can get it in a multitude of different ways. Mm-hmm. The most alarming one is from your cat. Most people get really surprised and somewhat irritated when I say that, but hey, it's a fact. You know, don't kill the messenger. The cats transmit it. There's no way around that. However, I'm not trying to scare you away from your feline friend. With simple precautions, you can prevent yourself from acquiring this infection from your cat. Specifically the cat feces, you know, so it goes into the litter box. And if you clean that promptly and safely and wash your hands, you're probably very minimally at risk for acquiring toxoplasmosis. You're probably more likely to get it out in the environment where a cat may have gone to the bathroom, like in a sandbox or a garden, maybe your yard. Unwashed fruits and vegetables, for example, you can acquire the infection that way too, even if you don't own a cat. Another common way is through contaminated water or through contaminated food products, meat products. So if you don't fully cook your meat, Toxoplasma cysts could be embedded in the flesh of that animal because all animals get infected with this parasite and you can ingest it that way.
So this infects a lot of animals, not just cats.
All warm-blooded animals.
But why are cats so important?
Cats are so important because it's the only species where the parasite undergoes the sexual stage of its development and gets excreted out of the tailpipe of the cat.
Yeah.
If it gets into humans or any other non-feline creature, it doesn't go through the gut in the same way. It doesn't have sex in your gut, which is probably a relief to hear.
Yes, that's probably a good thing to know. But
there's no parasite getting it on in your gut, or at least Toxoplasma is not. Other parasites.
I'm sure other parasites are having the time of their life in my guts.
Right, but that's why you can't get it, you know, from the fecal matter of another animal.
Right.
You can get it, however, from the cysts that get into its organs or tissues.
But tell us about the mind control part.
No, see, okay, I'm just going to time out.
Yes.
I'm now convinced that Shihir just invited you because he wants to give me crap about owning a lot of cats. And
not at all. There's none of that intention. We invited here because of who you are, but also to make fun of
you. Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I'm listening with bated breath about why.
Now, tell us about the mind control part.
This is the fun part. Yes.
Yeah. Right. Before I get to that, though, there is one important thing, pathogenically speaking, and this part's serious, Maggie. pregnant women who get infected with Toxoplasma for the first time during the pregnancy, that can lead to a spontaneous abortion or catastrophic birth defects. Mm-hmm. And we don't test pregnant women in this country, unlike some other countries do.
Interesting.
I tried to write articles to get that changed, but really can't seem to get people excited about it. Even in a country that is, quote, so pro-life, really don't seem to want to incorporate a simple toxoplasmosis test into prenatal care. And the reasons just boggle my mind. But that is a very real concern. Yeah.
But is it
otherwise,
expensive? I mean, is it just like a big expense?
That's the argument. Mm-hmm. But new tests have been developed, one of which is based on saliva. And Rima McLeod at Chicago developed a $4 pinprick blood test that can be done.
I mean, it's simple.
Really effective, really simple. And the costs are very manageable. And you wouldn't have to test every pregnant woman. If she's already positive, there's no danger.
Right.
So you'd only have to test the ones that aren't positive yet. Mm-hmm. So I think the cost, even though that has been an argument put forth, doesn't really hold water.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to go back to the mind control
question.
So like we said before, this parasite camps out in the brain. When you get infected, you get like a mild cold. You probably don't even realize the parasites entered your body. And what happens is your immune system controls the infection very quickly. You know, unless you're immune compromised, of course, in which case it can be life-threatening. Mm. But for most people, the infection stops growing very fast, and it forms these dormant tissue cysts. It can happen anywhere in your body, but the predominant number seems to be found in the brain. And that's the scariest place to have parasitic cysts because the brain is so central to who we are. It dictates our personality and behavior by and large. And to know that there might be a parasite up there turning the knobs on your behavior is a little unsettling, especially when it's in one third of the human brains in this world. So we really don't know how the parasite is doing that. It is one of the subjects that we investigate in my laboratory at IU School of Medicine. And other pathogens do this too. There's a number of viruses that have a tropism for the brain. And they can affect behavior or predispose people to neuropsychoses, like toxoplasma can also do. You have a twofold increase in the odds of developing schizophrenia if you're infected with toxoplasma. Very interesting study has been done on cat owners. Just by owning a cat, you are at a 1.9-fold increase of developing schizophrenia.
Oh, man.
And most people attribute that to toxoplasma, because it's strange that the two different types of studies have been done and both of them came up with the exact same risk, calculation. So it's probably not a coincidence, but to Shahir's point, we'll interject that disclaimer. There is a caveat there. Confounding variables.
There is a caveat.
Do you know if that increases if you have more than one cat?
I don't know if that's been formally documented, but I can't imagine otherwise.
All right. I'm just going to.
But, you know, I guess, Bill, this may be me being a little cynical, but you're saying one third of people in the world are carrying around toxoplasma. Sometimes it feels like one third of the people that interact with, there's a parasite controlling something there in their brains. And sometimes I feel like there's a parasite controlling my brain sometimes. So I feel like it's not too far-fetched.
Well, there's been estimates that it can be as much as one half of the world. So it depends on which study you look at. And yeah, I understand a lot of people when I start talking about the behavioral side effects and the neuropsychoses. I mean, the other ones we didn't mention yet is that there's a heightened predisposition for rage disorder, for reckless behavior, gambling, drinking, alcoholism, all associated with toxoplasma infection. You have a 3 times higher rate of getting involved in a car accident if you're infected with toxoplasma, which kind of speaks to the recklessness.
We
see these same behavior modifications take place in other species, non-human primates, hyenas, wolves, and mice.
Wow.
All have these, the common thread through all of these studies, when they have toxoplasma cysts in their brain, all of these animals, humans included, take more risks. Wow. They are less afraid of any stimuli that would normally make uninfected animals or people afraid. So anytime you see someone doing a lot of risky behavior, there's a very good chance they might have toxoplasma infection.
So this is actually pretty, it's very obvious with mice, isn't that true? So mice tend to engage in these like very dangerous behavior. Can you tell us more about how like the mind control works in mice?
Yeah, I wish I could. We don't know the molecular pathways of manipulation. There's a couple different schools of thought and some preliminary evidence. It's why this has to be investigated a lot more aggressively. My own lab has done studies that suggest that it's not the parasite per se. It's actually the neuroinflammation that the parasite causes. that creates these behavioral anomalies. Yeah. Because we've treated chronically infected mice with anti-neuroinflammatory, so mm-hmm. we can get the inflammation in the brain toned back down. And we see those behavioral changes revert back to baseline when we do that, even though the parasite is still in their brain. If you take care of the neuroinflammation, you can rescue their behavior, which may create a new therapy moving forward. It's way too early to tell, but it's a very tantalizing piece of information. And it might also explain why other pathogens like viruses can do the same thing. Mm-hmm. It might not be the pathogen per se, it's the neuroinflammation that results from it.
That's very, very interesting. So it's supposedly that mice then engage in these risky behaviors if they're infected and they're experiencing this inflammation so that they can somehow get eaten by cats and then the parasite can propagate itself.
That was the so-called fatal attraction model that holds up. We did the same repeat experiments in my laboratory because it's a really it's too cute of a story to borrow the words of a famous parasitologist who didn't believe it at first. And this hypothesis got started in the 90s when mouse models were being developed or rat models were being developed for toxoplasma infection. And people who were infecting these rats, even though they're they seem perfectly fine, they don't exhibit symptoms of illness. If they have cysts in their brain, they're not behaving normally. They're moving around a lot more. They don't seem to remember things very well. There's some cognitive deficiencies, and they're just a little crazy, okay? And one of the landmark findings was that they were no longer afraid of cats.
Wow.
And that's true. That will happen. But they're no longer afraid of anything.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
They're no longer afraid of anything.
Yeah.
But what people have latched onto, understandably so, is that if they're not afraid of cats, these mice or rats are more readily going to be prey. They're going to be eaten by that cat. In other words, toxoplasma, through the power of evolution, has figured out how to manipulate a rodent brain to get into the host it really needs to get into, the cat.
The cat. Yes. So, wow.
Such an odd host to kind of pick. I mean, I know they don't pick, but
yeah,
cats are just do any of those mind control tactics happen in cats as well, or because they're kind of the host in some sense, a unique host, do they not engage in some of those riskier behaviors?
Yeah, that's true.
I don't know. Cats are so weird, so I don't know. Cats,
you don't know what they're thinking anyway.
Yeah, Maggie, that's a great question. And to the best of my knowledge, no one's looked at that.
Wow.
But there's no reason to believe that it wouldn't be true.
Mm-hmm.
Because in all other mammals where chronic toxoplasmosis has been looked at, we see these same behavioral changes.
Mm-hmm.
So that wouldn't surprise me in the least.
Mm.
Well, Bill, I got to say that I heard you talk many years ago at the University of Notre Dame at a conference. It's MNID. Right.
Midwest, yes, I remember.
The Midwest Neglected Infectious Diseases. And, you know, it's a lot of researchers who are doing research on neglected infectious diseases, you know, the diseases that affect people either very, very far away or things like toxoplasma that affect a lot of people but don't really have the same kind of like, you know, severity that we would see with something like malaria, for example. And I was one of the organizers of this conference, and I was asked to bring in a photographer. So I brought in one of my best friends, and he's a professional photographer. I said, hey, can you come and take pictures of this? The guy's not a scientist at all, right? And he came in. He was bored out of his mind until your talk. And when you started explaining what toxoplasma does in a very, very plain way, of course, you went into some of the molecular biology and some of the assays that you guys do and some of the, you know, science. But very early on, you talked to everybody like a human being. And everybody was able to understand. And to this day, my friend remembers toxoplasma. And he says, I remember to this day. It will manipulate your brain. He still remembers it. And he said,
That's incredible.
This is why I don't have a cat. I don't want a cat because He says,
well,
that.
I feel a little bad that I deterred someone from getting a cat. You know, that, like I said, there's very safe ways to have a cat or two, Maggie. And but that's really remarkable. Yeah. I that kind of warms my heart to hear that after all these years, someone can still remember an impression from a research talk that
I gave. To this day. So I think your talk really stood out. And also, for the record, I don't think you deterred him from getting a cat. It just reinforced his aversion to cats. He's more of a dog person, always been a dog person. But this is, I think, the power of a good story. And I think, you know, I remember actually a talk very, very well. And this many, many years ago, you had a cartoon of a mouse just standing on a sleeping cat.
I think I still use that photo.
And it's such a great photo. Perfect. Because it really gets the point across. So you're using that visual aid, the story, and it really resonates. And I think all of us, everybody remembered that. I couldn't tell you a single thing about any of the other talks, but your talk resonated. And I think it really speaks highly to, obviously, you're a talented science communicator, you're a talented speaker, but also just the power of, you know, anybody can do this to some extent, just using some of the things that you've talked about. Being personable, telling people what you think they would actually understand, using stories, using illustrations, using jokes, using pop culture, and even 80s song lyrics too.
Well, I,
absolutely.
Do you have a cat, actually, was going to be my next question.
I do not, but it has nothing to do with toxoplasma. I am allergic to cats. Oh. I can't be around them for a couple minutes without starting to sneeze and going in, just become a watery mess. Oh, so that is my main reason for not having a cat.
So you mentioned that there's safe ways people can have cats. And I didn't know that there was like any other way to have a cat other than just how the cat decides it wants to be. Are there, you know, I know for pregnant women, don't change the cat litter. Are there other things that people can do to kind of mitigate their risk of being infected?
Absolutely. So the main way a cat would get infected are pretty much the same ways we would. Mm. So if they consume dirty water, or if they go outside and hunt and maybe eat raw or undercooked meat, mm-hmm. or pick it up from the soil or garden, the cat will get infected that way. Mm-hmm. So it's, if at all possible, you know, a cat that's kept indoors all the time will be very minimal risk of giving you toxoplasmosis, because it probably would never get infected. Mm. Now, if you feed your cat raw or undercooked meat, there's a danger of it getting infected at that point. Mm-hmm. Like I said, dirty water can also be an example of that. So, those are the main things. And then cleaning the litter box promptly is important, because if the cat is infected and it's producing oocysts, it'll crank out like billions of these over 2 weeks. So prompt cleaning of the litter box is useful, because it takes about 24 hours for those oocysts in the feces to ripen, if you will. Mm-hmm. And they don't become infectious until the atmosphere reacts with them and then makes them ready for infection. And that takes about 24 hours. So some cat owners are really bad about cleaning the litter box promptly.
Oh, boy.
But if you do it quickly, you minimize the chances of infection. Another thing people can do is get their cat tested. If they already have toxoplasmosis, it's not going to shed oocysts again in the future. And many cats, if they were like bred on a farm or something, they probably got toxoplasma very early in their life. So there is a reasonable chance that your cat already has it. Mm-hmm. And they only get this infection once. They only shed the oocyst one time.
Oh,
yeah. So even if the cat is infected, that's it. It's really, you get it right as the cat gets infected.
Yeah, you can kind of think of it as like a vaccination, if you will. Mm. You know, it already had its infection. It expelled oocysts for that 1 or 2 week period. It's not going to do it again.
Wow.
Okay, so maybe I'm good. Maybe I don't have it. Because my cats are nice, lazy inside cats. So
yeah, that's true.
So I think the risk would be pretty minimal.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay. Good to know. See, I'm good. He's always teasing me about, I have three cats.
I never tease you about anything.
But I, you know, I've heard of all of this, but there's so much I didn't know that now is super informative.
Absolutely. So, yeah, this has been really, really informative because I thought I was under the impression that once they have it, then they shed it their entire life.
Yeah,
but I didn't realize that they just shed it right as they get infected. But that now that makes perfect sense because they're building antibodies against it. They got rid of the infection.
That's right. Yeah. So if they do ingest toxoplasma once again, their immune system's going to nip it in the bud.
Get rid of it.
Where the parasite has a chance to go through the sexual cycle again.
Yeah. Excellent.
Very good.
Very good. Well, Bill, thank you so much for joining us on Rust Belt Science. This has been delightful. It's just so nice to hear science explained so well. Mm-hmm. And we learned so much today.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here, and I appreciate and applaud you for providing this forum, you know, for scientists to come on and talk about what they do. It's wonderful.
Thank you very much. And of course, if you have not picked up a copy of Bill's book, Pleased to Meet Me, please go pick it up. It's an excellent read, easy read, very easy read. It's really a fun read. So I highly encourage people to pick up a copy. Thank you again, Bill. And I'm sure we'll be in touch soon.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That would be great. And if people want to check out follow-ups on the book or read my more recent articles or follow me on social media, they can check out authorbillsullivan.com. You can find all that information right there. And thanks to both of you again so very much for having me on.
Yeah, we'll put all the stuff, the link to the book as well, in our show notes so that people can listen to this episode and find all the ways to find it, all the cool stuff you've put out. So
thank you, Bill.
Thank you so much, Bill.
At the end of our show, we would like to thank you, our lovely listener, and our awesome audience for spending your time with us. We thank the Notre Dame College of Science and the Indiana University South Bend College of Arts and Sciences. Special thanks to the wonderful people at the Notre Dame Studios. Coming to you from beautiful South Bend, Indiana, in the heart of the Rust Belt, this is Rust Belt Science. I'm Shahir Risk.
And I'm Maggie Fink.
And we'll catch you next time.